Alan Kring Productions, in association with Emergent Light Studio, presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, Academic Lectures in Business and Economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240, for spring semester 2022. Today, component costs of capital. Before we do that, just a quick look at the numbers, and then we'll jump into the lecture. On Friday, we'll have a quiz. I'll finish up, do some cleanup on what I'm doing today. And right now, though, let's turn on the projector before I go too far here. But the Dow had a grouchy day. It wasn't anything spectacular, although the NASDAQ did take kind of a slide. But as you can see, the Dow lost a little less than half a percent, and the S&P 500 lost more, riskier, at 0.82%, and the NASDAQ, well, the markets are still open, but it's getting down 1.25%, so greatest risk, the greatest possible down swoop. And if you look at the S&P 500, though, again, we're seeing that really troubling lack of volume. We're almost at the end of the day now, and we've got less than 1.4 billion in volume. Typical day, almost 4 billion. So the big dogs are staying off the playing field right now, waiting to see what happens next. Taking it back over here, of course, good news, the glad news is that crude is up again, as I told you. It's going to keep, it'll have down days. Don't get me wrong about that. And good news is going to, as far as oil supply goes, it's going to slide the price down, but it wants 125. That's a reach, but it's going to find it here. Now, the interesting thing is that gold and silver are up. So money was going into the metals, and this isn't little money. This is a percent up, which is, for both gold and silver, more than a percent up, which is a little unusual for recently when they've just kind of gone up and down a little bit. So the money is flowing out of the equities. The stocks are going down, and it's flowing toward metals. And here we go with the bonds. The bond yield is down 4 basis points, which means the price is up, which means investors are buying bonds. So they're getting out of the stocks, the riskies, and they're moving to the bonds and the metals, the safer. Flight to quality. It's nothing major right now. Don't get me wrong. This isn't some scramble to get out of the way of the apocalypse, but you see a quiet movement away from risk right now in the markets. Over in overseas, London had a spike at the end of the day, and I don't know what got them so excited there. You can see on the spark chart, you can see a little bit of a pop. It was in bull territory all through the day, but then it had a real spike there at the end. Now, the Nikkei on the other side of the world last night, by our time, it was going down through through the day in Tokyo, but then there at the end, there was a bull run. It didn't make it into positive territory for the overall day, but there was a bull run there. So I don't know what's gotten the foreign markets so happy, but it's certainly not doing anything for the markets here in the United States right now. We're in a down swoop. Now, going over here and having a look at the yield curve, we are getting deep now. This is seriously 9 basis point inversion on the 710 leg. And then we have another one. Do we have one? Yes, we do. Right there on the 3.5 year, we've got another inversion, 2.5 to 2.49. So 2.54 to 2.49. So we've got a double inversion there, an inversion on the 3.5 and an inversion on the 710 leg. And that is pretty much guaranteeing we're going to have some trouble. Here's the hilarious part, though. Just in the last 24 to 48 hours, suddenly the business and financial news services are saying, oh, there's an inversion. Wow, big news. Well, you guys have been seeing it for the last 2 weeks, for heaven's sakes. Yield curve below closes on an inversion yesterday. Gee, silly. Well, part of the U.S. yield curve just inverted. Does that mean a recession is coming? Well, that was 2 days ago, so they were ahead of the curve for everyone else, as it were. Yield curve flashes recession warning 10 hours ago. Just now, they're catching up with it. This is the reason for your education here. You become informed investors, informed citizens of the business and political world, so that you know things before the media catches up with it and they find out. You're seeing right here, they're talking about this like this is something that's just happened. For heaven's sakes, it's been going on for a couple of weeks now. So that's one of the practical uses of an education like this. And thank heaven you have a great professor like me teaching you, or something like that. Here's the thing. I'm going to do a summary of what I did on Monday. I'm not going to motivate the formulas. I'm just going to write them down so that I can take you to one more step in this whole process. Now, the equity and debt, these are the component costs of capital. Now, on the debt side, your R sub D, your cost of debt. The easy way to do it would be to take the coupon on your most recent debt. The riskiest debt. A company is going to borrow and borrow and borrow. And every time it borrows, it's going to pay a higher coupon because it's more subordinated debt. So what you would do is say, okay, well, they've got some junior debt out there with a coupon of 9%. So we could use that. But it's better instead to say, what does the market want that to be? That's the yield to maturity, the YTM. And I mean, that's listed in the quotations for bonds, yield to maturity, the YTM. So that's not really much of a difficulty there. But the bond might have been issued at 9%, but the market now says that that coupon should have been 9.35%. The yield to maturity is that. So in other words, the next time the company goes out and borrows money, it's going to be at that yield to maturity, where the market says it should be paying now for its debt. If it might even be a little more than that. But we also appreciate that the company will deduct its interest expense pre-tax, so the one that we will want to use is the R sub D times 1 minus their marginal tax rate. Don't forget that. That's what makes debt so cheap. Here's a weird thing. Now, your textbook is actually somewhat out of date. I've been fussing at them because that your textbook doesn't even include the latest tax structure. But even in the book, they point out something that is a rather troubling thing. If you look at the large corporations, I mean the giants, like Walmart, Coca-Cola, companies like that, you calculate their after-tax cost of debt, and you're seeing numbers that are actually below the risk-free rate, as proxied by a one-year treasury bill or something like that. I mean, these, what is it, like Walmart is below 2%, Coca-Cola is like 1.5%, 6% after-tax cost of debt. I mean, these are ridiculously low costs of debt for these corporations. So that goes to that old saying, debt is cheaper than equity. And I mean, it is staggeringly cheaper for these huge corporations. They're so safe, they can't fail. It's sort of like a Walmart's never going to go into default, a Coca-Cola's never. And so they're lenders will throw money at them at very low interest rates because the debt is so safe. So kind of keep that in mind, that the larger the corporation, if it is a stable old corporation, it's probably going to have awfully cheap debt. So now equity. Now the equity, I motivated these formulas. I'm just going to list them for you. On the preferred side, it's a straightforward formula. The cost of preferred stock is going to be equal to that constant dividend. It's stated in the stock certificate. The owner of this stock will get 1.5% of par value $50 per year forever. I mean, it's just a flat dividend, quick to calculate, divided by the current price of the preferred stock. I mean, this is like a gimme. Just have these formulas for you on for a quiz and for the final exam, and just plug the numbers in. Don't try to make it rocket science. That'll get you into all kinds of trouble. Now, however, we go to common stock. Excuse me. That's the one where there are three different ways to calculate it based upon the circumstances. Now, the cleanest way, the pretty way, the theoretically best way would be to say that the return to the common stock would be the capital asset pricing model approach. R sub F plus the beta of the stock times the expected return to the market portfolio minus the risk-free rate. Like that. Just plug the numbers in. There's your Uncle Bob. The problem with this approach is, well, for the biggest one is, do you have a beta for the stock? Some companies don't have a beta. They're too young or something else about them. And also, you are going to have to estimate the expected return to the market portfolio. If I give you a problem where I say the beta is, well, you know I want you to use this approach. Just plug it into the CAPM formula, the capital asset pricing model formula. Now, the next way works only for a company that has stable dividends. It's an older company. Its use goes beyond that, though, because it informs us of what the dynamics of the cost of capital, cost of equity is. In this one, the cost of common stock would be the dividend one period out divided by the current price of the common stock plus the growth rate. Now, the dividend one period out would be the dividend, current dividend, times 1 plus G. Now, remember when in these formulas, I could say the company will pay a dividend next year of, and then you've got the D1 right away. If I said the company just paid a dividend of and it will grow by, then you'd have to get the D1 by multiplying the D0 times 1 plus G. Again, it's just a matter of translating the words of a problem into the numbers to plug in. But if I said in a cost of equity capital problem, if I mention a dividend on this common stock, you would know that that's the one. So that's your keyword for hitting the second, using the second formula. Now, the third one is practically the one that is quite popular. You just take the cost, you say the cost of common stock is going to be the bond yield plus an equity premium, RP. In other words, for a typical company like this one, what's its bond yield? What's its cost of capital? And then you would know the overall equity premium on these kinds of companies, and you would add that to this company's bond yield. Let me say that one more time, is that you would find a bunch of companies similar in risk to this company. Find their average bond yield. And then also look up in a service what their cost of common stock equity is. And then you would say, okay, that difference is the risk premium, the equity risk premium, so I'll find my company's bond yield and add that risk premium, equity risk premium to it. Like I said, this one is actually quite popular in practice. And overall, I mean, if I compare that to the CAPM approach, they're usually pretty darn close to each other. And this third one is actually pretty quick to calculate, pretty fast. So there are the three different ways of doing it right there. Nothing complicated about any of those ways. You just have to know which one I want you to use. And that would be the key on a future quiz, or not the quiz this time. I don't ever test on the material for the week of the week in a quiz of that week, but in a future quiz and on the final. Just make sure you know the key word that would be tell you which one of these formulas to use to get that kind. Now, I tie all of that together in the lecture on Friday. It's a brief lecture, and it's a really fast thing, just the weighted average cost of capital formula, the WACC. There's one thing that I have left out of here, though, and I'll tell you a story from my own consulting. But first of all, I'll mention something. You see, when these big companies go out to get equity capital and debt capital, they're not going to go out and say, yoo-hoo, can someone lend us money? We'll sell you bonds. Or yoo-hoo, will someone buy our stock? We'll sell you stock. They don't do it that way. They go through an investment banking syndicate. Some of the best jobs that I place for my students is with the IBs, as we call them. Up in Chicago, there are a bunch of them. I took a group, my finance club, about 4 years ago up to a regional IB up in Chicago. And I mean, this is what they do for companies. A company wants to do an IPO. Okay, we work out all the details, figure out a good price for the IPO, and then we buy that stock and we sell it to our clients. That's how it's done. A company wants to borrow money. Well, we work out the bond issue, things like the coupon and the how long the bond has to maturity and all that, and then we lend you the money. In other words, the company sells the investment banking syndicate the bonds, and then the IB goes out and sells those to its clients right away. Sometimes it keeps some for its own portfolio. But it's done that way. Now, here's the kicker, though, is that they're going to charge you, the company, for this. Okay, you want to sell your stock at $50 a share. Okay, you want to sell 1 million shares at $50 a share. That's $50 million. But you're not going to get a check for $50 million. We're going to keep some scratch for ourselves. We call that the flotation cost, or the float. Now, what is that float? Back a long time ago, it was a really big amount. These days, it's supposed to be smaller, but there are ways that sometimes you'll see the float expressed as a dollar amount. 50 million, we keep 5 million. Other times, it'll be expressed as a percentage, 10%. So keep that in mind as I go on here. But what is this float all about? First, a quick story. I teach a version of this course. It's the same course. It's MBA level, 440. But it's really this course. With a different book, and we say it's an MBA course, and I make it, you know, kind of a big-sounding thing. You're doing a finance MBA course. Wow. It's really your course. Don't ever tell them I told you. I'm saying this on a podcast, but okay. Here's the thing, though. Interestingly, in that book, they start fussing about flotation costs, and it's everywhere on any kind of an issue you would do. Whether it's common stock or preferred stock or debt, there's a float. My experience has been that's not true. There's a float, and it's a heavy float on common stock underwritings. But with debt, well, first of all, with debt, I mean, there is such a vast ocean of capital that wants to invest in debt instruments that the IBs hardly charge anything at all. I mean, it's literally like a phone call. Yeah, we just bought $50 million worth of debt from this ginormous corporation. Hello, life insurance company. You got $50 million kicking around for a debt issue of a AAA? Oh, yeah, sure. Just kick it over here. It's no work at all, and the float is minimal. Now, the interesting thing is that that MBA, they don't do this in your textbook, but they do it in the MBA textbook. They say preferred stock has really got a big float. No, it doesn't. I did a consulting gig for a type of company called an REIT. Now, an REIT is a real estate investment trust, and they are huge, and hardly anyone even knows these things exist. These were authorized to allow to exist in tax legislation in 1960, I think it was. Here's how it works. An REIT invests in real estate. It's a real estate investment trust. In commercial real estate, it'll buy a shopping mall, maybe an inside mall or a strip mall or an apartment complex, something that is a commercial real estate enterprise. They'll buy it. They'll fix it up, and then they'll flip it. As long as the REIT gives back to its shareholders 95% of its profits as dividends in any given year, it's tax exempt. They are monstrously popular for that reason. And you can place preferred, and some of them use preferred stock. And they don't even go through an investment banker exactly. There was one I did a consulting gig for an REIT in Ohio some years back. I was just setting up their software. There was a real estate REIT software coming out at that time. I think it was called Argus. And so I was setting that up just when they were in the process of acquiring a strip mall in Kansas City. Well, they had gone out there, they had surveyed it, done the assessment, and they had negotiated a price of $900,000 for this strip mall. And they were going to upgrade it, get new management in there, and then they were going to flip it within about, their plan was 6 to 9 months. They got back $900,000. They called this bank in Japan. It was a bank/investment bank. And the conversation lasted no more than 20 minutes. And this bank said, sure, okay, you get us the documents, and we'll sign them, fly them back by DHL, and we'll wire transfer $900,000 to your bank account. It was preferred stock. The REIT issued preferred stock to this bank in Japan, and they got $900,000. There was no float. I didn't see, maybe there was, but I sure didn't see it. $900,000 just appeared in the REIT of this, in the bank account of this REIT. It was about 48 hours, it was. And then they went out and they did their meeting with the owners of the strip mall and they bought it right there and then. There was no float on the preferred. Where you see the float is in common stock. And that float can knock you dead. At least it did back in my time. I'll give you a story about this. Back in the time when I was working with rainmakers, in other words, those who have huge amounts of money, I had gotten involved with two young men. Through an intermediary, their two families had gotten with me, and they say, if you will go with them and make sure they don't get into trouble and use our money wisely, we would really appreciate that. And they had a huge amount of money, and I didn't bother to ask where they got it, which turned out to be something of a problem later. But, okay. We did a couple of really quick, fast deals, little public companies that needed capital, flipped them over. Got some money to them. These were private placements, not public offerings. They were private placements of common stock. And then there was something unusual. They called me and they said, we've got you a ticket. Fly to Atlanta and meet us there. We'll all be there by 6 o'clock. And this little company is in a back lot of the Atlanta airport. And so I got there, and it was getting to be about evening, and we rented a really fancy, expensive car. That's how we did it. We walked in with our fangs out and our heads up. And we were looking around there. There were all these little companies in these trailers all over this back lot. Some of them were carrier services or shuttle things or repair companies, airplane repair companies. But we found the big trailer of this company, and we went, knocked on the door, and we went in. It was a mess, just stacks of papers everywhere. I mean, binders full of papers. And the guy who was in there was old. He had a silver beard. He looked old. He had steely blue eyes, and he had this big cigar. He said, "Come in, come in." And he told us his story. A big carrier out of Europe called Lufthansa had gone to Tap City a few years before. His plan was to lease the MDs that they had and use them to rent out for DHL, U.S. Postal Service, carriers that needed packages delivered overnight or something like that. It was actually not that well known that this was a growing, huge, growing business. Now it's everyone does it. But back then it was unheard of. And he had all of these FAA approvals. He had all the documents to meet the licensing and all this. And he had pro forma income statements and balance sheets, which I just sat down and started pouring through, and I was making comments. And for some reason, he liked me because I had been a pilot, and he said, "You have the vision, yes." And it went through it. It was a go. There was no question. He needed $5 million. Okay. Well, one of the young men was very aggressive, very well-dressed, very professional. He said, "Okay, we're going to get the money together for you, looks like. It will give us 2 weeks, and you'll sign the documents for $7 million. And he said, "No, it's $5 million. He said, "Yeah, $7 million. We keep $2 million. Oh, he just flipped. He crapped himself, just waving his cigar, embers flying. And we just got up, thanked him, and we walked out the door. Now, the whole game was this. The one young man and I would walk very quickly to the car, which we deliberately parked a ways away. The other fellow, who was a very nice, very gentle-voiced, baby-faced, he walked slower. Well, sure enough, we heard yelling behind us, "Wait, wait, wait." And so the younger man yells up to us, "Can you hold on just a minute, please? Come on. Come on, guys." And so we go to the car, and we just sit there, stand there looking irritated with our big old mobile phones. Mobile phones at the time were big. And looking at our watches and all this kind of stuff. He went back, and they talked. And so the young man finally runs up to us. And he says, "We got him, $6.5 million. Is that good?" "Yeah." "Okay, we had a deal." You understand the game, right? Okay. And so everything worked out. $6.5 million, a $1.5 million float on a $5 million. In other words, his company was going to start with a burden of $6.5 million in shareholders' equity on the book, even though he was going to have only $5 million to work with. That's what the float does. It bleeds the company from the balance sheet out to the butt. And, you know, that's how it works. He was going to be wearing all of this extra cost of capital that wasn't going to do a thing for the productivity of the company. Good deal. Well, actually, unfortunately, the deal fell through. Did any of you ever see the movie Made in America? Okay, here's how it worked. He called us about a week later. He said, "It's all off. We can't do it. FAA has given a final denial. Won't let me do it under any circumstances." "Why?" "Well, because I kind of was convicted of felonies for flying marijuana into the United States in the early 1980s. "You what?" "Yeah, it was part of the deal." "Are you kidding me?" Here's how it worked. The drug dealers would pick up bales of marijuana in Central America. They would fly them up to the coast of the United States. They would unload them, sell them to the dealers, the top dealers there, in quick trades on abandoned airfields. And then that money that was paid for those bales of marijuana would go to the CIA, which and the CIA would go to Iran, of all places, and buy weapons to get down to the anti-communist rebels in Nicaragua, the Sandinistas, okay? The anti-Sandinistas, okay? It was illegal as hell. It was all black box, and he got caught on the airfield flying in. Of course, he swore to God to the DEA people, no, I'm working for the CIA. Yeah, that worked. And that was the end of it. This was the story of what came to be the Iran-Contra scandal. A bunch of pilots were flying dope into the United States and raising money so the CIA would have the scratch to buy weapons for rebels around the world. Yeah. And, of course, the cover blew off it, and it was all in the movie Made in America, which starred Tom Cruise. True story from beginning to end. So I thought, every time I saw that movie, all those pilots and those planes, yeah, one of those was probably the character that we'd been talking to all that time. But anyway, that has nothing to do with the float part of it. The float part was clean. Now, how do we incorporate the float into this common stock? You don't have to worry about it anyplace else. But this is actually existing common stock. I write that with an S. I think they use an E in the book or something like that. It's existing common. What's your current shareholders cost you? Someday, madam, you may have a partner. Maybe one of those marriages I've heard about. Don't do that. But that partner is going to cost you. You own him, and therefore, or her, whatever, I can't stand the politically correctness anyway. But here's the thing, though, is you see, that person will be a cost to you. But now you decide you need something else, something new, something extra. So you see, that will cost you more. Him, you just have to feed him at night. You know, maybe put some dog food out in a bowl or something. But someone new, you're going to have to pay for. You have a car now. If you get a new car, it's going to cost you extra to go with your old car. You see, the new has a higher cost than the old will. That's that float that's going to up the cost of bringing in new shareholders because you're going to have to pay someone to bring them in for you. So that's how do we incorporate that? It's actually very easy, okay? This is the cost of existing. The cost of internally generated equity. Now, the really sloppy term, but unfortunately it is used, even the book uses it, this is the cost of your retained earnings. That accumulation of what belongs to the shareholders on your balance sheet. The cost of the new equity, what we sometimes call externally generated equity, you have to take into account that you're not going to get the price of the stock. If the stock is $50 a share, well, to get more shareholders, you have to pay some of that $50 that the IB, the investment bank, gets to the investment bank. You don't get to keep that. Just like that fellow had $6.5 million, but he got only $5 million of it. That's the float. And it's really easy to put it in here. All you do is say that the cost of new equity, common stock equity, is going to be the same D1 over price now of the common stock. I should have put a zero. Yeah, I did. Okay. Times 1 minus the float plus G. Now, I can give it to you as 5%, so that would be like $50 times one more is minus 0.05, or I could give it to you as a dollar amount. Every share of stock has a float of $4 or something like that. I could give it to you either way. Just know that you take the price minus that float, whether it's a percent of the price or just a flat dollar amount. Now, historically, back in the day, back in my time, it sounds like that 1.5 million on 5 million is a horrible amount of money. That's a 30% float. Truth be told, even in the legit operations, as far as, you know, nice building in on Wall Street or in Chicago or something like that, or in Dallas, it was pretty steep. I mean, you could talk a 0.20, a 20% float on an issue. Now, rules came into effect that reduced that. It puts a cap on what the float is. Truth be told, it's still a pretty steep thing because there's always these extra fees and the attorney's fees and the accountant's fees and the consulting fees. So it really is, when I say 5%, that's just what we say these days. It's still pretty steep. So know that if you're going to go out there and raise money through through issuing common stock, it's going to be expensive. And it's going to take away, you're going to be on the hook with shareholders to the tune of a lot more money than you actually got from them at the end of the day. That's just how the game is played. This is another reason why we always ask, why are you issuing common stock? Why aren't you just borrowing, issuing bonds? Common stock is expensive to begin with. And when you add in the float for getting those new shareholders, good grief, it's awful. A quick little problem here. JVM, common stock, just paid a $2 per share dividend that is expected to grow at 4% per year. If the current price of JVM is $25 per share, what is the cost of their existing equity, common. Okay, this one is going to use this formula over here. Because it's existing, we'll use this one. Now, we have a dividend they just paid. So D0, we were given D0, is $2 a share. So we will have to grow that one period to get to the D1 that is used in the formula. So we're going to say that the cost of common stock right now that is already outstanding is D0, $2 per share, times 1 plus 0.0. What did I say the growth rate was for? 0.04. Divided by... Oh, weighted average cost of capital. I forgot to do that one. Is, let's say, 11%. 0.11 minus 0.04. So the cost of their existing common stock would be $2 per share. Right now, grown one period, 1 plus 0.04, divided by 0.11, Whoa, 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 I screwed that up. No, 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 I'm sorry. That's 0.11 plus 0.04 right here. My bad. Wow. Divided by 0.11 and then plus the 0.04 out there on the side. So their existing common costs them 18.95%. Now let's look at if they issue new common stock. If they issue new common stock, it will be the $2 per share times 1 plus 0.04 divided by the price. Whoops, I screwed this up. I'm screwing up everything. Stop and delete this. The price of the stock right now is 25. Wow, I'm talking too fast because I want to get through this. So the first one is RCS equals $2 times 1 plus 0.04 divided by the price, $25, plus 0.04, the growth rate. Thought that number looked a little high. Try it one more time. $2 times 1.04. Wow. Divided by the price of the stock, 25, plus 0.04. There we go, 12.32%. Whew. Whoa. Now, the cost of the new. If the float is 5% on new issue, the cost of new equity will be $2 per share, grown one period, times 1 plus 0.04, divided by the 25, times 1 minus 0.05, plus 0.04. So doing it again, $2 times 1.04 divided by, now I'm going to put this all in parentheses, $25 per share times 1 minus 0.04. Then plus the growth rate, 0.04. I'm sorry, 5%. That's 5%. Growth rate is 5%. I'm sorry, the float is 5%. The growth rate is 4%. I have to do another one of these tomorrow or Friday. 12.75%. So you can see that the cost of the new equity is more than the cost of the existing equity. It's because it's not 25 in the denominator, it's 25 minus 5% of 25. That's what causes that increase of the cost of new capital over existing capital. Okay, I'll pick this up on Friday. That's all I have for you. I thank you.